Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so proud and happy to be talking with Franz Wright on the line. We're talking to him from Massachusetts. Franz.
Hi.
Franz, welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you. Thank you. Are you there on the farm?
Franz, I'm here in the studio here at WCBN.
I thought maybe the Buddhist farm had a radio station.
You know what? I would be there if it did, yeah. I think. How about you? Would you be?
I'd like to have a radio station. I'd say all kinds of secret one that they couldn't trace. I'd say the truth.
You know what? I think that we could really use one of those, and yeah. And I think WCBN is trying to do that as much as we can. Really,
Good.
One of the last bastions of freeform radio.
You have to be able to swear, though.
Right. Maybe
I can't swear. I know.
We talked about that, Franz.
Yeah.
maybe after 10 p.m. you can. I'll have to check with the FCC code. But Franz, before we go any further, I'm talking to you, and you're talking from Massachusetts. We're going to
Well, I'm in Waltham, which is about 10 miles west of Boston.
Okay, so close, Waltham, close to Boston, and we're going to be hearing new poems and also prose poems from your latest book, Kinder Totenwald, mm-hmm. and...
Ah, you pronounced it right. Did you take German? Do you know German? Do you speak...
My dad's family is German. So because my last name is Hetzel, so
we
both have the Z.
You got the W right. You got the W sound right.
Yeah. Is it something? Do you hear? Are people when you're going places? Are they? I don't know. Are they saying? Are you getting strange pronunciations?
I mean, not everyone can speak German. It's the only language. No, I mean, German and French are the only languages that I'm familiar with, so I don't assume that everyone knows German. I know they don't.
Right.
That's why, partly the title. I thought it had enough cognate, you know, sort of English-sounding word. Kinder, like kindergarten, children. Tot is dead. Vault is woods. You can make compound nouns like that in German. I coined that word. And
So this is actually a make-up-y then.
Made-up word. Okay. And I was told by my old teacher, Stuart Friebert, there at Oberlin College, that who was acquainted with Paul Celan, who was, I'm not sure if you know his work.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's considered one of the major poets of the Holocaust and of the 20th century. And... my teacher said he would have approved, so that was like the greatest compliment I think I've ever received.
And tell us a little bit about why you made like the layers of meaning then inherent in the word.
I'm not sure. I think I have to say from the start the way I said to I was doing an interview for the Huffington Post with Anas Chobani, and I said I need to say right from the start that I don't know why I write. What I write, it comes to me, and I write it. I write what I'm given to write. But I did have some ulterior motives once I thought of it. It delighted me to think of, I thought it would be very eye-catching. If I was, you know, in a bookstore and I happened to see that title, I would want to get up close and go and puzzle over it. It looks like an object, the way German words do, but this one really does. It almost looks three-dimensional. It's a beautiful word.
It's mysterious.
And yeah, and I thought it would make, you know, a curious-minded person. I know that I would go, I have to find out what that means. And they're like hooks, reaching out, grabbing the potential book buyer.
And you know what?
Every book sold is a cheeseburger for me.
So hear, hear.
That's about all. And yeah.
Franz, before we go any further, I'm going to read your short bio in the back of Kinder Totenwald, and then we'll go forward, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Franz Wright's most recent works include Wheeling Motel and earlier poems.
Wheeling, as in Wheeling, West Virginia. Wheeling Motel.
Walking to Martha's Vineyard was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2004, and he has also been the recipient of two National Endowment for the Arts grants, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Fellowship, and the Penn Volcker Award for Poetry, among other honors. He lives in Waltham, Massachusetts, with his wife, the translator and writer Elizabeth Olkers Wright. And you were recently in Ann Arbor and reading at the Copper Colored Mountain Arts Collective.
Beautiful, beautiful place.
And you were reading some of the poems from Kinder Totenfeld. Would you mind reading us one?
I have difficulty. What I would do, I guess, is give an example of two shorter things, because I tried to use prose in every single way that I could think of, story, fable, formal things like that, and then other made up forms. But it goes from one pole to another. On the one hand, it can be very, very lucid and just sort of very simple minded and literal, and on the other, it can be very enigmatic, and it approaches what my old teacher Charles Simic used to call the lyrical absolute, where you almost take leave of meaning altogether and depend on the music of the language. So I'll try reading one of those. It's the very last prose piece in the book. It's followed by there is one lyric poem, one actual verse poem to my wife at the end. I could read this and then read that. I don't know. Let me try reading this song. Wisteria rain, where is your child mother? This must be the last bee on earth. So you find no more grandeur or mystery here? Perhaps you neglected to bring any. Heckling sparrows, vast electron cloud of gnats on windless water, night blue volume in a language no one reads. Are we tired yet? Are you finished debating the blind who insist that light does not exist and have proof of it? Nobody's alone. God is alone. If you liked being born, you'll love dying.
Thank you, Franz.
And then maybe I'll read you, I know, the very first poem in the book, which is equally very short and is in the lucid. Anybody with a, sixth grade reading ability ought to be able to read this without any trouble. It's a little strange. It's called Winter Sleep. I was a boy, and it mentions Minneapolis. I was a little boy in Minneapolis growing up. I was having trouble sleeping. I don't know how long I'd been lying there and listening to the blizzard when I had the most vivid impression that it was a blizzard in Minneapolis in 1959. And I found this disturbing. I knew it would now have to turn on its lamp, get out of bed, and try to write about me. And of course, no matter what it wrote, it would just sound like something it had made up. But in the end, it decided to stay put, turn over, and keep me to itself. I think that was the right thing to do. After all, it was only a blizzard in Minneapolis in 1959. How are you supposed to describe something like me? And when you think about it, why should you try? Why should you even care?
And those questions, Franz, those are setting the course for the whole book here.
Do you think?
I think.
You see, I learn about the book from other people. I don't really know. And there's an element of randomness in putting a book together, and there's an element of order. There has to be a balance. But I'll tell you, there are times when in these pieces where I simply don't know what they mean. I don't know.
And is that when you feel like the writing, that upwelling, that energy, that you're,
well,
you know it's
that,
right?
I feel that I've stumbled onto some, if the writing rises to a certain level of, in a number of ways, rhetorically, syntactically, if it has a certain kind of music and rhythm, that I find pleasing. All kinds of qualities have to be present all at the same time, and then you go, okay, I'm in this voice, and I can start to... it gives you a few lines, usually. I get a few lines, and I go from there. I branch out, and I try... It's as if I were trying to do a translation, someone said, of a non-existent text. It feels, I can sometimes actually see how long the poem will be, what form it will take, like four-line stanzas, or whether it will be 15 lines long, things like that. And then I get the words to fit the form.
And you see, and you almost have this sense of it then, Franz?
Well,
I've
been doing it for 42 years.
Yes.
And after, you have to learn something in 42 years. You would just have to. And I've learned a lot of tricks about how to, I feel at this point, only in the last couple of years have I felt that I have something to say about what I'm writing. Usually it was just whatever was given to me. I just had to do the best I could with wherever it comes from. You have the sense that when I write something that I know is good, I know very well that I'm not intelligent enough to have written that. I have a sense of some more intelligent, happier person telling me what to say or speaking through me. I really do. It's not my normal voice.
But coming from you, and so is it, so is it part of it? It's, some of it seems, it's like it always will be rooted in mystery.
No.
Is it accumulated?
It's the voice of, it's often the voice, I think, of the person you would like to become, or the person you're afraid of becoming, or I think some writers like Samuel Beckett have written almost exclusively in the voice of someone they were deeply terrified of becoming, like a bum, a homeless bum. Many of his characters are, and I think he was afraid at many times in his life that he would end up that way. There are poets, I am doing both. I will go back and forth between, habitually I'll go back to darker times in my life and write in that voice, but I also strongly feel that I need to write in the voice of the person I could be, the higher person, you know, the better person that we can all be.
And it's hard to talk about that, Franz, isn't it?
Because I don't find it difficult.
No.
I'm often accused, I use the word accused, of being part of the confessional poets. I don't really know what that means. Well, I do know what it means. It was a group of poets writing in this country in the late 50s and early 60s, such as Robert Lowell, Sylvia Plath, John Berryman, Anne Sexton, a certain group of poets that I was not even born. Well, I was a little boy. I had nothing to do with. I want to ask them, is Wordsworth a confessional poet? Is anyone who uses the word I in a poem? So I made up a term, the mask of the first person. Rimbaud said,
yes.
One of the foundations of modern poetry, I, he said in a letter, I is another. I is someone else, in effect. It's a mask. When you say I, now why is a poet not as free as a fiction writer?
Right.
When you read a novel, you go, did that really happen to that person? But when you read a poem, you think every word is autobiographical and absolutely, literally true. And people are startled to find they meet you and they have a conception of you. And often you can see that they're surprised. They picture you in a different way. I don't see why a poet shouldn't be able to slip into different roles. And the greatest poet in the English language was Shakespeare, was pretty good at that. And it's something a poet should... Yeats wrote about wearing all the masks, knowing what all things are like, what it's like to be all kind of different people. Not just me. And Whitman had the idea that if you go deeply enough into the personal, and if you're honest with yourself, you'll break through into the universal, what's yes. universally true for everyone. If you know yourself totally, you will know everyone. So there's that idea. That's a theory.
And that's that compulsion to even keep, like part of that, keep writing, to attempt to know yourself,
I don't know
whether
the compulsion to continue writing is kind of an illness almost, I think. It is a compulsion. You use the word compulsion, and I think in some ways it is a clinical compulsion, something you just have to do in order. I know it's true of me. I'll speak for myself. From the very start, and I was about 14 or 15, I got a feeling that I needed to have again, and it got to be so that I had to have that feeling no matter what happened, you know, like I had to pursue it.
And that's when you were 15, that was about the time when you found poems.
Yeah. I started to write, yeah.
And what were the ones, like, what were you, because you said a few moments ago, Franz, that you were, what was given to you. So you were making a distinction
between
the higher
self. A lot of things given to you from your particular, what's dealt to you in your particular life, your background, what you read. Sometimes people forget that if you be a writer, you might want to do some reading. I've had students in the past who have told me they don't read. It might influence their style. I said, you have no style because you do not read. You know, reading is... why would someone want to do something that they didn't love? You know, like an art. I mean, why wouldn't they take up something else if they didn't... You know, it's bizarre to me.
Yeah.
So I was always a big reader as a child, and then suddenly I found myself writing. I never expected to. I thought I was going to be a musician.
Oh, really?
Well, they're close. I think poetry is closer to music than it is to prose in some ways.
Yes. Unless
you're talking about this kind of prose which seeks to be poetry, which longs to be poetry.
And what's that, Franz? What do you mean by that?
Well, the so-called prose poem. Yeah. And I don't like the term. I'm sure that at the beginning, when it was more or less coined by Baudelaire, I think, he's not the first one to do it. There was somebody before him that he was copying, but I think he made up the term. It's a wonderful oxymoron, fantastic. But it doesn't have any punch anymore. A prose poem doesn't mean anything anymore. I was tempted to just call the book Poems and then have someone open the book and go, it's prose. And then gradually it would dawn on them what I meant, that this is poetry.
Yes.
Poetry is not just a matter of, you know, kind of gimmicks. You need to have a mastery of English prosody, but poetry is a kind of music. There is a point where language does turn into a kind of, you know, it has a sound dimension, like music, like singing. In fact, poems were sung. In the past, it would have been unheard of to speak a poem. They're the lyrics of a poem. They're called lyric poetry. There's a song, there's the music inherent in language, and you need to dig it out and glue everything together to bring it out, to bring this magical side of language out.
And that's why maybe the second to the last poem, the one that you actually read to us first, right. was you titled it Song, and you said it's right. these lines are trying to find their way into the music in a way, and then you turn the page.
They kind of lift off it, not all the way, but there are some that are much stranger. They really lift off into a state that would leave behind all rational paraphrase. You would not be able to paraphrase them. The one I read, you could and you couldn't. Now, how do you paraphrase Wisteria Rain, Where Is Your Child Mother? I just heard that in a dream, and I used it to start a poem. I don't know what it means. It really doesn't mean anything. Literally, it sounded like the key to something mysterious that I would never really understand, but that was real, and it wasn't just gibberish. It was sounded real somehow to me, but I don't know what it means.
And that also might be like a reason why it's towards then the end of the book, because it's still opening.
Well, there's plenty of other places all through the book where this happens in a much stranger way than that. That's nothing. And then, like I say, there are places where it's perfectly literal and straightforward. It goes back and forth. I think of this book more in symphonic terms. I had the sense after a while that there were certain motifs that kept recurring, and there were quietness, a speeding up in time, a slowing down, all kinds of qualities that one associates with music. I started to feel I was dealing with. And in one piece, one of the longer pieces, I started to literally feel that I was counting each syllable of the, you know, I knew where each syllable was and why it was there, every stress.
And are you saying it out loud, Franz, then, at this point?
I do that when I'm alone. I walk up and down and say, recite out loud or to the cat, lines, or I sit silently and mutter them to myself. But it's always a matter of counting. I'm counting beats. I never write a line. This is why I say it's kind of a compulsion. I cannot write a line of verse or prose in which I am not absolutely aware of the number of stresses of beats and the number of syllables and so forth, the length that it's going to be by the ear, not by the eye, like, you know, I'm going to make it this long and then the next line. I do it by the ear. So that it's certain to be genuine and not just prose with arbitrary line breaks. You know, there's a reason lines are broken where they are, for those who know something about English prosody. And it's a neglected study, I think, sometimes, and that produces very mediocre poetry.
When you... I actually love how you said this, like a line would come to you in a dream, and I was reading how you also seem to use walking as part of the process, where there might even be...
Sadly, I'm having trouble with that. I'm having a very serious medical condition, which is making it difficult for me to walk, but I'm getting it back. I spent a year being treated pretty roughly, and intensively, and it left me kind of a wreck. But I have something in me that always seems to make a comeback, and I'm not too worried about it. Sometimes it shocks me. I'm so thin, you know, but I can hardly look at myself in the mirror, but I'll get it back. I'm starting to exercise again. And walking, yes, is the greatest joy when it comes to... just for its own sake, there are cities that are wonderful to walk in. I love walking in the country, anywhere, because you can be solitary. You see, I see people walking around now with their ear glued to a cell phone, and I think, my God, I used to leave the house to get away from the telephone. you know, it was a form of solitude to me, and I think I'm deeply worried that there are generations of kids growing up thinking that you must constantly be talking to someone at every moment. We're always thinking about checking your phone. I see them. I've seen college students doing that. You're talking to them. They're not with you. Mm. They're with whoever's on their plastic machine there. And they are depriving themselves of God knows untold the wealth of quiet, silent, solitary state in which you can hear into yourself. There's an inner stream of conversation going on that you can dip into, but they are constantly distracted from that. That is another reason, that plus the ubiquitous MFA programs, two reasons why I believe no real poetry will come out of the generation presently and the one before it. I think someone's going to have to realize that poetry's going to hell and do something, angry, the way people are getting angry politically, and do something about it.
Well, I think it's connecting to what you said earlier, Franz, about trying to know the higher self, even, because if there's this cacophony of
there is a definite analogy, and it is only an analogy. It is not literal, but it is an analogy that a poet, any artist, unless they're artists who work dance or theater, who work with other. I mean, a lot of artists, painters, writers for sure. Writers definitely cannot do their work unless they have a profound attachment to solitude, because it requires hour after hour after hour of being by yourself. That drives some people crazy. And if you cut down on the tolerance that you have for being alone, you are destroying yourself as a writer. So any young person who aspires to be a writer, to give it some thought, you will not be a writer if you do not cultivate solitude. It won't happen. You won't hear the upwellings, as you said, the good word, from the unconscious.
Franz, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back to talk more.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Franz Wright, Kinder Totenwald, his latest collection of poems. And we're going to hear some new poems, new work, when we come back. We'll be right back.
Night flight turbulence. Some things need to be done in the dark by yourself. I'm not saying it's right. In the greenly lit restroom, I looked pretty ill, like a vampire locked in a confessional. The drug had no effect whatsoever. Maybe slightly more arctic and fearful. Angel of meetings, long despaired of, poor girl. We could put something together to eat or watch an old movie. You and me, friendless in this winter city, glimpsed for a minute as far off lights passing under the wing. Just two more cripples Jesus never got around to. One theory says we won't remember dying any more than being born. Can you go at this hour? Stay with me.
A WCBN. You've got Living Writers on WCBN, FM, Ann Arbor. Today on the program, I'm speaking with Franz Wright. His latest book of poems, Kinder Totenwald. Franz, welcome back to the program, because you're joining us.
Thank you for playing my... I don't know how the engineer managed to do that so fast. That record.
That's that Brian Delaney.
From a CD, my big CD, Readings from Wheeling Motel. Wheeling Motel is a book of poems in 2009. And it's 20 poems that I recited, and some musician friends of mine from Los Angeles, one of whom, Michael Rosan, who's very accomplished, produced bands like the Melvins, who were there with Kurt Cobain, going to high school and being in bands and big in that scene up there, and an accomplished musician. And when I had a review in the New York Times Book Review, which is what sells a lot of books, we happened to peek at the Amazon charts, music charts, and I was, for one day, I was number 11 on the ambient music charts, the top whatever, like almost top 10. One day, I was like a rock star.
Lucky number 11,
yeah.
I think. That's one of my favorite numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was beautiful, and you could really feel your voice as the lyric.
That's one of the more successful ones. I just think that I'm very skeptical when people set poetry to music, but this was just he really picked up them. Whatever it is, the poem's trying to express, that move, that music definitely accompanied it correctly.
So did you go out and actually read with him?
No,
as
no,
the
no.
One
of them, Daniel Ahern, who's in a band called Ill Lit. They named their band years ago after a book of mine.
Yes.
I had a book called Ill Lit, selected and new poems, and we got in touch. And he's a wonderful, wonderful band. He's a very, very gifted alternative type rock band. You know, like. Really, I know a couple of them. Another one is Clem Snide. I have a track on their last record called, their record is called Hungry Bird, if there's any Clem Snide fans out there.
That's right, Encounter at 3 a.m.
Right,
that's the
right, yeah. I'm very proud of that. I really want to reach an audience that is beyond outside the literary world. The literary world is disgusting. It's filled with all kinds of strange psychic disturbances, envies and hatreds and different schools. It's like a war right now. I don't understand it.
How do you navigate it then?
Well, for me, I was so fortunate. God made me a very troubled lunatic who could not hold a job. So I was kind of on the outside of society in a lot of ways. I did teach for 5 years at Emerson College in the 80s, part-time. I couldn't have taught full-time. And I've had different jobs here and there, but mostly I got very fortunate with awards. They kept me going in the 90s, Guggenheim and so forth. And there were a few pretty bad years. Again, I've had some years when I was so broke that friends had to help take care of me, and they did. And I try my best to help my friends with a place or with money when they need it, and because I wouldn't be here if people didn't help me. Poets are in a... You try to be a poet. You try to be a full-time poet in this... I do not know another poet of my generation. I literally do not know a single poet of note who does not teach in a university or school. And I shudder when I think of a future in which they look back and say, just think, they're poets. It suggests something, you know, subversive a little bit. Their highest ambition was to be, was to live in school forever.
No,
to
yeah.
me, it's a nightmare. You know. So I'm glad I missed out on that. And so I didn't really know what was going on. So it was easier for me to stick to my own development. That's the point. You need. I think a writer ideally would not publish a book till he or she was 40 years old. That you would spend this entire long incubation gestation period until you found the secret of writing, which is to write the way you would use language if you were speaking. Pound said to Yeats, "Never write in a poem anything you would not actually say to another human being, albeit under the stress of great emotion." He meant, use language the way we use it now. Don't speak in the 19th century or Elizabethan English. It's right away, you've ruined the effect of, you know, the greatest poets have always known to speak in the language that people actually use. How else can you touch them? How else can you move them or inspire them? A lot of poets aren't interested in inspiring people, strangely. I would think that was the job of poets in some ways, to
yes.
inspire people. There are whole schools like the Language School of Poetry where technique is all. It's a kind of robotic. No one will ever cry reading a language poem, for example. It's very strange to me. It's very alien. But I was out of it. I didn't know what was going on. Thank God.
And so, in that way, you—that's how you shaped
vision. Think about it. In your early 20s, one of the most self-conscious,
yes,
terribly. Pain, excruciatingly, the need to be loved is so overwhelming, the need to fit in, to conform, no matter what you say, you need terribly to be affirmation, and you can go looking for it in places that are quite lethal, that
yeah.
may destroy you in some ways. I taught once, one semester in a graduate workshop, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, wonderful school, wonderful town. I loved it there, and I love universities and colleges. I want to get it straight. I love scholars. I love people who teach. I can hardly imagine a greater thing to do than to be a teacher, and I know how good it feels to introduce people to new great things. It's a great high. But writing poetry is not a degree subject. The very idea that I would be getting a degree for writing poetry would make me shut down completely. And I had a student who showed me work that he had done that was marvelous first year. Then he was told by his peers there that, no, that's not the way we do it currently, fashionably. We do it this way. So he tried to write that way, and it didn't work out. It was crummy. I had to tell him, it's just crummy. He was crushed. I mean, he had to get his degree, but of course they give it to anybody who pays their tuition. It's that you buy one. I said, can you go back to writing?
Right.
And he could not.
Oh.
It means that what Rilke said has been proven, that you can destroy your connection to the subconscious for writing by being too early immersed in a group of other writers who don't know anything either. And then it becomes a contest of power. Who has the most charismatic personality? Things like that. And you may lose, if you have a talent, you may lose it.
But hopefully there might be that way back to find your secret
writing.
I don't
think there is.
Like the, because Franz, you were inspiring me when you said, like, what it is to find your secret of writing.
That's right. And you're not doing that when you're sitting in 12 blind people sitting in a room are not going to discover any of the secrets about light. I'm sorry. I do not mean to use blind people as a sightless people as a it's tasteless of me to use them as an example. All I mean is people who do not know what they are doing, the traditional, you know, use of the word blind, and are blind people leading blind people, like Gates said, into a ditch, you know, it cannot work. It will not last. It is a scam, a capitalist scam on the part of the academic world to make money. You have students who are glad to teach lower-level courses in English and get paid one quarter of what they would have to pay a trained teacher. Then you get students who are being taught by a person with no training as a teacher. The fact that you are a good writer and publish a book, does that mean you're a good teacher? No. And you may be, but it's likely that you're not. You have no training. How are you going to go about it?
And Franz, you make a good point, because some people are just sometimes trying to make ends
meet. You pay your money to be taught by someone who has no training as a teacher. That's all I'll say.
But
now, by saying these things in public, by exercising what I understood to be my God-given and constitutionally guaranteed right to say what I think.
Amen.
Well, I broke the first rule of correct adult behavior. Never say what you think.
Right.
If you want to eat and have a place to live. We all know that. But in reality, you cannot say what you think. But I don't give a damn.
I salute you.
At a certain point, I didn't care. And I stopped caring. I stopped sending my stuff out. I said, I will just write in secret. When I die, they'll find it, and they can decide whether it's any good.
So how did it get out, Franz? What happened?
I won the Pulitzer Prize.
But who? But what was that moment where it was all in secret? And then, what?
From one moment to the next, a phone call on April 5th, 2004, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, my life was set on a trajectory that is so opposite to the one I was at 51, I was used to, that it was very frightening and disorienting to me, and I had a hard time dealing with it.
So what
I had
happened?
No practice in it, and I never expected it. I know people who have received that kind of critical scrutiny since they were in their 30s, and they were used to it. I had to learn fast, and I made many mistakes. But I've tried to turn them around. For example, I was the laughingstock at Poetry Magazine for several years, and it caused me great pain. I wrote to them, I was angry about something or other, wrote to them four not very well thought out emails in a row to the editor, thinking this is not a letter. Also, I am told or have read that you do not publish a letter unless asking permission,
right,
calling the person. That never happened. He published them as if they were four fired off messages from a lunatic, and all the little kiddies had a lot of fun laughing at me for several years. Now, I have been accepted four times in the last couple of years at Poetry. In their next issue, they will be announcing, and I can say this, they told me, I'll be receiving their highest prize, which is the prize given for the best poem published over an entire year. And they publish some pretty hot people.
Yeah.
This means you are, you're the king of the cats for a minute. You know?
I'm glad, Franz. And hey, was talking about sort of the king of the cats of poems. Before we came on the air, you had said there's this poem that you've written more recently. Could we hear that one?
Were you talking about? I have.
Because you're on fire the last couple of years.
Yeah, I am. I've written three books in 2 years, and it's killing me. If I have to finish soon because I don't have the strength to go on anymore. But I'm still getting some good ones, and I believe this, to me, This, I don't know if it's the best one. It's my favorite of all. I've written hundreds of them. 65 were in this last book. This is my favorite one. There is a peach tree growing in my backyard. Now, that would not be odd if you were in Georgia or something, but in New England, I mean, it is an anomalous situation. What is a peach tree doing in New England? It made me feel like myself. Now, I've lived in the Boston area and in New England for longer than I've lived anywhere in my life, and I've moved all over all my life. But I've lived 15 places even in Boston, and I consider myself a resident alien. I do. I feel like an alien, and I identify with an alien. And
this peach tree.
Yeah, the peach tree was an alien. So anyway, it's called Peach Tree, and it gets into, there's a passage, I will warn you that, now, there's no need to be alarmed, because it's quite tender and very beautiful, actually, but there's an erotic element towards the end of the poem. It is not offensive in any way. Peach Tree. Winds are blessing one by one the unlighted buds of the bent peach trees. Unnoted return. This is spring. At first light, gray, I stand beside the tree, my height. Such fragile branches as of bark-covered glass. How did we ever survive, find our way home, and take up again our alien stand here, reappearing at the tip of one of endless branching roads, a dead end finally, one of quiet's addresses, where I would endure 5 more years lying low, survive until I didn't. I'd often wondered where it would happen. So, one more northern spring has been given me, too, frail peach tree. You look good. You look like you could go on doing that forever. I have no more idea what I look like than you do, I am happy to say. All of that is over, that business with the mirror. One lifelong winter afternoon, I noticed it had stopped. I couldn't anymore. That was all. Wish I'd thought of it sooner. Trembling with the effort not to break between thumb and forefinger, this one hidden branch I identify with and am trying to lift and lower my eye to. Leaves receding as I reach out, some force inside me, pushing them away, maybe. I hope not. I hope that isn't so. Because I long to touch, polish frictionlessly, a velvet row of greenest dark beginnings, infolded growths destined to develop into nothing more than stunted fruit stripped from their boughs overnight by blackbirds. I wish I could go inside one of them, past the tough rind, into one of identical pink, erect, closed eyelid-colored buds, curl up the size of a comma, and wait there for the softly sifting wind to find me, lift me. Wait there, alone with everyone else in the darkness before we were born. How did we ever drift into this chill state? I'm feeling kind of backbent myself, and I see us both bound for the fire, long peach tree, then nothing, then pure spirit again. Even Lazarus has to die. What have I done? What have I been so afraid of all my life? So that's that.
Thank you.
And I'm very pleased with that one. I wrote it 100 times. I had a kid write to me on Facebook and say, "You take weeks to write poems? If I had to take weeks to write poems, I'd just throw it out and start on something else." And I said, I didn't want to humiliate him, but I said, "My God, I routinely spend years on a poem. I have a poem in my new book that took 30 years to write. I put the dates underneath it.
Oh, yes.
And it's a one-sentence piece. It boiled down to that. That was it. 30 years, I carried that around with me. I do that a lot. I'll use things I had in notebooks 20 years ago. I'll plug them in. I'm lucky to have a good memory.
And a way of.
Want to hear the one line?
Yes, please.
It's called. Used to be called knife. It's called blade now. If I stare into it long enough, the point comes when I don't know what it's called anymore. Condition in which lacerations are likely liable to occur, like a slip of the tongue. When a single drop of blood might billow in a glass of water, blooming in velvet detonation and imparting to it the colorless, tasteless, and sourceless fear in which I wake.
And so since 1975, Franz, this poem you've been carrying with you?
75, yeah.
And does that mean that's like... When you're saying that, you're walking around with it, and did you feel like it was something that was still, like you were...
Well, I store them up. Yes, I do. I store them in notebooks, individual lines, and stanzas, not connected to fragments, and I keep them swirling around in my head, and when I find a place to plug one in, it's all there. That seems to work for me.
Yes, and it doesn't seem like plugging, actually. It seems more
I want them to seem seamlessly part of, and I do my best. It's a magic trick, though. writers will get around and, it comes, again, out of doing it so much. Another thing I suggest to younger writers is translation. I cannot imagine a better way to learn about how a poem is made. If you translate first of all, it's a wonderful way of reading the poem as closely as possible. You think about each word. And the second, it's like taking apart a watch or an engine or something and having to put it back together again. You learn how it's made.
And you and Elizabeth have recently translated Valsina Mort?
No, that's a misunderstanding. Valjina Mort from Belarus. Yeah. It's a great misunderstanding.
Oh, no.
That was not a case of translation at all. They used my name to sell the book. What I did do...
You met her in
it's
Ireland.
It's very important.
Did you?
Is that I helped her render her not quite their English into idiomatic English. I was of the opinion that she should wait if she's going to write in English until her English is better. But it's very difficult to write in another language. Poetry reveals the secrets of its own language, and it must be very frustrating to write in a language that nobody else really speaks, so she almost has to. I think if it was me, I'd write in Belarus and translate it then into English. But anyway. My wife is a very accomplished literary translator who concentrates on Turkish-German emigre writers in Germany and is doing one, Zafer Zenicek, who's very famous in Germany as a journalist. And she's the one. I've done it from time to time throughout my life just for pleasure,
And did you do it as a young poet, Franz? Because
I started when I was... in fact, my father and I did one, a Hermann Hesse book of poems, together when I was still in high school.
Oh, was that The Wandering? Was that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Came out in 1972. Helped pay my tuition through expensive school.
That was an important book for me at a certain point. I wanted to even pass it on to someone, and then I couldn't.
You know what I recently realized what he's doing? He writes a prose. My father did the prose, and I did the poems, and then we kind of like worked together, like he said. And I realized that it's very much like a form used in... I don't know, 1600s, 1500s in Japan, when you get a poet like Basho. Oh. He writes in a form called a haibun, which means a diary-like entry in prose, setting up the situation, the context, and then showing the poem that was the result of that situation. Yeah. Very beautiful, very moving. And Hesse, obviously, he was immersed in Eastern studies, and Germans are very fascinated with anything Chinese, and Chinese poetry leads to Japanese poetry, and I think that's what Hesse was doing in that book. He would write a diary-like entry, then he'd write a poem, and that was I never realized that until recently.
And you were translating the poem piece of it.
Yeah, not very well either. That's a book that makes, that's a cringe, for sure, cringe experience if I see that book.
Well, for someone...
I was 16 or something, 17.
Wow.
Well, very bad job.
But your father must have trusted you.
Well, they did. The editor at Forrest, Rouse, and Drew, which is, and my father felt that it was good enough. I don't think they were, pitying me. They had to publish the book. I think my father touched them up a little bit. But I'll tell you the truth. They aren't very good poems.
That's
the problem. Now, my father did another book, just of poems, which is magnificent, magnificent. Of course, he saved the good ones for himself, And these just aren't very good poems, frankly. They're kind of corny.
Well, you know what? Maybe I was corny because I read it when I read it in my 20s.
That's when people love Hesse. He's one of those writers. My father even says that in his introduction to one of the Hesse books. What is wrong with that? Think of all the wonderful writers, including somebody like D.H. Lawrence, who are most read when we are young, most loved when we're young. When we get older, we feel, we see the flaws, but we're madly in love with them when we're young. I think that's a great thing to do, to inspire younger people.
Oh, yes. Is Rilke someone that stays with you, though, Franz?
Yeah, I think he stays with everyone. It's like saying, does there are certain poets that we are writing like them, even if we do not know that poet. We've reached that point. William Carlos Williams, people write routinely, use technical effects that Dr. Williams invented as one of the earlier modernist early 20th century poets.
Franz.
And I've asked students, and I know they do not know his work, but yet they were writing in his style,
his way, going towards what the most honest thing inside of us to write. Franz,
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I think it can be a way of being, of dissembling, of not in a sinister way, but of being other people, of wearing masks. I don't see poetry as self-expression. I see it as an attempt to express something universal.
Yes. That what is honest in each of us, I think...
I don't think anybody is capable of very much honesty. It would be too hard. Eliot said human beings cannot bear very much reality, and I would say honesty as well. I think we constantly, the way we look in a mirror to our own advantage so that we look best, that's how we mostly, that's what we call honesty, I think.
Well, Franz writes... as honest as I can be. I've loved speaking with you this hour. Thank you so much.
Did it go by already?
It's gone by already. Wow. And so if you'll stay on the line, I'd love to say goodbye, a quick goodbye to you off air. And thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Sorry I talked so much. I didn't let you talk very much. Next time we'll interview you.
Okay. Thanks, Franz. But that was the point anyway. You've been listening to Living Writers. Today, Franz Wright, his latest, Kinder Totenwald. Thanks for listening.
Now, from WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, an hour of programming randomly selected from our archive.
Everybody has a dream. Everybody's got the sunshine. Everybody's got a hunger. Surprise, surprise.
WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor's non-stop alternative radio network.
We are the ones that have been waking up the world. You don't want me to go to sleep. Pull the plug out of you and you'll be dead. I got a computer at home that's mean that was invented back in 1930-something. You know, the piano roll, you scared of that. How hip is a computer?
Good morning. You're tuned to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. My name's Terry. Name of the show is Sleepwalking. It's also the name of the song in the background right now. This is Goblin. This is taken from the soundtrack to the 1977 Dario Argento giallo Phenomena. After this, we're going to hear from Can. We'll hear a new track from the Jeff Parker Quartet from the recently released record on International Anthem.